This is Audible.
Recorded Books and RB Digital present The Lost Colony, The Long Winter, Book 3, by A.G. Riddle. Narrated by Eduardo Ballerini and Amanda Lee Cobb. The Lost Colony contains several maps and drawings. If you would like to view these images as you listen, please visit the author's website at agriddle.com.
Chapter 1. Emma. The rolling thunder wakes me. I lie in the bottom bunk, listening in the darkness. The narrow mattress is just big enough for James and me, but he's gone. He has been for most of the last 6 months.
Mom?
Allie whispers from the lower bunk on the opposite wall.
It's okay, sweetie. It's just a storm.
The thumping in the distance grows louder. The walls vibrate. I'm sure of it then. This isn't a storm. They've returned. I push up and pull on my suit. It's made from a specialized material that blocks the heat from my body. We used the 3D printers to create the suits, and they've saved dozens of lives in the last few months. Sam climbs down from the top bunk as Allie swings her feet over the side.
Where are you going?
Sam asks.
To work. Mom?
Allie starts.
Stay quiet. You'll wake your brother.
It's too late. In the bassinet, Carson rolls back and forth, breaking free from the tight swaddle wrapped around his tiny body. He yawns, and a yell follows. That noise could be deadly. For all of us. I grab Sam's shoulders.
Get a bottle from the canteen, give it to Carson, and keep him quiet.
He shakes his head.
I'm coming with you.
Do as I say, Sam.
Where's Dad?
Allie whines.
Be quiet, both of you. Now go, Sam. Hurry.
He scowls as he marches out the door. Allie looks up, lip quivering. I lift Carson out of the bassinet and hand him to her.
I'll be back soon.
Across the hall, a door opens, and my sister, Madison, sticks her head out.
Everything okay?
The pounding beyond the barracks is growing louder by the second.
Sure,
I lie.
Just try to keep quiet.
Sam is racing back down the corridor, bottle in hand. I pause just long enough to hug him and whisper,
Thank you.
Outside the barracks, I march toward the command post. Overhead, a canopy made of parachute material blocks out the sun, making it feel like night. During our first few months on Eos, the lack of night here in the valley disrupted our circadian rhythms, so we built the canopy to simulate the setting sun and darkness. There are 14 long barracks buildings under the domed canopy, and people are pouring out of each one, mostly army troops in green fatigues. A few wear the insulated suits like mine, but we only have 20, all fitted specifically to the owner's body. If we had more of the necessary raw material inputs for the 3D printers, we could make more. And in moments like this, when I wish we had more, I think maybe what James is doing is truly important enough to risk his life for. He's spent countless hours away from Jericho City, scouring the dark side of Eos for material we can use in the 3D printers. Inside the small habitat that serves as the command post, Colonel Brightwell is issuing orders rapid fire, her voice low, the British accented words snapping out like suppressed gunfire. Launch both surveillance drones. At the long table in the middle of the room, Corporal Aguilar types quickly at his terminal, then looks up.
Drone launch confirmed. Initiating startup.
How long until we have line of sight with Carthage?
Another hour,
the young man responds.
Launch the relay balloons.
All of them, ma'am?
All of them, Corporal. We need eyes in the sky, and Dr. Matthews may want to issue orders to the ship before it reaches line of sight.
Brightwell pauses, seeming to consider her options.
Activate Alpha TAC team. I want them in the jungle ASAP. And that group's vector. Orders are to take up defensive positions and await further instructions. No active measures until authorized.
Another technician relays the order over the radio. Brightwell turns and realizes I'm here. She nods slightly and eyes the troops following me.
Major, she calls to a man behind me.
Lockdown protocol.
Yes, ma'am.
His loud, crisp voice makes me wince. The command post is a one-room habitat that's only about 500 square feet. Every inch of it falls silent. Brightwell sighs.
Quietly, all of you. The troops turn and creep away, leaving only the pounding in the distance, like a great battle at sea drifting closer to us.
Drone telemetry incoming, Aguilar says.
The wall screens switch from the perimeter cameras to video feeds from the drones flying above the city. The domed canopy is a giant white circle in the vast blue-green plain. It ripples from the vibrating ground, reminding me of a pebble skipping across a pond. A cluster of white comm panels lies nearby. Those panels are our only link to the colony ship orbiting above. The grassy field around our city is bordered on the south by a wide blue river with white-capped waves. The stream has surged since the storms began, but the water isn't our greatest concern. To the north, east, and west, the grass ends in jungle, a thriving ecosystem that reminds me of the rainforests of Earth. Yet for all its similarities to Earth, Eos still feels foreign to me. The sun it orbits is dim and orange-red, a red dwarf that burns less than a tenth as bright as the sun we left behind. The temperature is about the same as the temperature on Earth, since this planet orbits closer to its star, but I may never get used to the alien quality of the sunlight. Eos, like Earth's moon, is tidally locked. One side always faces the sun. The sun never sets on that side. It's boiling there, a vast desert. The dark side is the opposite, an expanse of ice and mountains that reminds me of my last glimpses of Earth, an ice ball devoid of life. It's only here, in the dividing line between the desert and the ice, that Eos provides a habitable zone, a band where conditions are just right for human life. This Goldilocks Valley runs all the way around the planet. It's beautiful. A paradise. Or so we thought. We made one miscalculation. There's a dwarf planet in this star system with a highly irregular orbit. The scans we performed when we arrived didn't detect the planet. It was too far outside the system at the time. But that planet is now moving closer to Eos. It won't collide, and it won't drastically change our orbit. But its gravitational pull has caused Eos to turn slightly, just enough to shift the Goldilocks Valley, causing a minor ecosystem disruption, an event that may well be our undoing. On the screen, the drones fly toward the western jungle. The canopy over Jericho City passes out of sight, leaving only the thick expanse of trees. The first time I entered one of those jungles, I was shocked by how dark and cold it was. The leaves and branches overhead are so thick it almost feels like night.
Switch to IR, Brightwell whispers.
The colors on the screen change to blue and black, and red. The red dots are life signs, and they cover the screen from edge to edge.
Zoom out, Brightwell says slowly.
The image widens, but it's still covered in red dots.
Again.
Finally, the entire group of red heat signatures is revealed. The dots form a diamond, and they're moving quickly through the jungle directly for this city.
Chapter 2. James. On the icy plain, Arthur stares at me with exasperation. Go home, James. Ignoring him, I glance down at the tablet, confirming the location. It's here, right under my feet. At the ATV, I pull a shovel from my pack. A cold wind kicks up, blowing snow like tumbleweeds through a ghost town. To the west, snow covers the towering mountains that separate the dark side of Eos from the habitable valley. The valley we call home. A valley that I fear is in danger from an enemy unseen and unknown. But the answers are out here. I can feel it. What do you tell them? Arthur asks. About what? About why you're out here. What does it matter? I mumble, as I walk back to the location on the map and begin shoveling snow. My guess, Arthur says, pretending to contemplate. My guess is that you tell them you're searching for material for the 3D printers. You bring back just enough matter to assuage their suspicions. Your deductive powers are breathtaking. It's almost like you're a machine, capable of running infinite calculations of the possibilities. Arthur smiles. Touché. But I'm much more than that. And I'm telling you that you should go home, James. He stares at me, serious now. Listen to me.
I'd already be at home if you'd help me.
I just did. The shovel breaks through at that moment, catching air below the snow that covers the entrance to the tunnel. I dig faster, uncovering the mouth of the passage. It's dark, a jagged corridor carved into the ice at a descending angle, just big enough for me to walk in if I stoop a bit. In the distance beyond the mountains, I hear a faint rumbling. Probably another storm coming in from the desert. Go home, Arthur says. I told you the storms of Eos are dangerous.
I'm not worried about the storms.
You should be. I trudge down the tunnel, my headlamp lighting the way.
Come on,
I call back to him. After a moment, I hear his heavy footsteps crunching in the ice. At the end of the tunnel lies a black metal sphere, slightly larger than a basketball. It's the third one I've found. I take a measurement and confirm that it's larger than the other two, but only slightly. A symbol is carved into the ice on the wall beside it. Harry made this mark. Was it a message to me? Or simply a marker for him and his team? He's dug around the device on all sides, allowing me to examine it. Like the other spheres, this one has no markings, only a single door that lies open. The hollow sphere is empty inside. The other two were as well. The first time I saw the symbol, the Eye of the Grid, Arthur calls it, I thought it was a map. I still do. My working theory is that these spheres are points on the map, specifically the closed circles on the top arc. Before, with only two points, I had no way to verify my supposition. The eye has no scale, no points of reference. The two locations could have been any of the two points, or none of them. But having three points changes that. On my tablet, I plot the points on a map of Eos, then overlay the symbol. They match. Using this, I can find every one of the spheres, if that's what's out there. Things will go faster now. I don't need the rovers combing the tundra looking for metal readings. I turn the tablet to Arthur.
It is a map. What will I find at the other locations? More of the same?
He rolls his eyes. I imagine you'll find that you're wasting your time.
That's cute.
I study the map a second longer, considering which point to search next.
There's only one line that terminates on this map. Is it the start or the end?
Who says it can't be both?
That's not an answer.
It's the only one you're going to get. I exhale. I'm tired and cold and sick of being in the dark, figuratively and literally, thanks to the permanent winter on this side of the planet.
We're going to the point in the middle. It's different, isn't it?
Arthur shakes his head, disgusted.
Why do you call it the Eye?
He stands there, looking uninterested. I think I know why. Because the eyes see everything. I pause, but Arthur doesn't respond.
No, it's more than that. The eyes see something very special, the beginning and the end. Is that your little secret?
His gaze snaps back to me, but he remains silent. I press my point.
What it sees in the beginning, it doesn't understand. We don't remember the first thing we see when we're born. We can't recall or understand what we see for years. But we see the end, with our eyes wide open, like the arcs in the eye.
Arthur's face freezes. His eyes go glassy. I know this expression. He has paused all bodily control functions. Every bit of his processing power is focused on some calculation. I've only seen this a few times. He's reassessing. Something I said has rattled him. Suddenly he reanimates, as if waking up.
Interesting.
What is?
You, James.
You didn't think I'd figure it out.
The probability was so small as to be indistinguishable from zero.
He shakes his head.
It doesn't matter. Don't go to that point or any other.
Why?
I step closer to him.
There's only one reason you wouldn't want that, because it might harm the grid.
That may be, but consider this. What if that's not the only reason? What if it could harm you?
You don't care about us. You've said so. You only care about the conservation of energy. The grid's great work, whatever that is.
People change. You're not a person. Not by your definition. But it doesn't mean the grid can't change.
So the grid cares about us now?
Is that so hard to believe?
Very.
Arthur stares at me. You've changed, James. In prison, when this all started, you were unafraid, even in the face of a riot that could have killed you. He pauses. Maybe you would have even welcomed it. You had nothing to lose then. Your family hated you. The world didn't understand how valuable you were. They rejected you, locked you away. But now, you have it all. Your brother's love, a wife, three children, a band of people who celebrate you and trust you. You have it all, and you're terrified you're going to lose it again. That's why you're out here. Your own fear, this sense of doom you've invented in your head. You've been fighting the long winter so long, you don't understand that it's over now.
It's not over. Now start walking.
Arthur doesn't move. I draw the energy weapon from my pocket and let it hang at my side.
Grigori made the device. One shot will completely disable Arthur. You can walk or I can strap you to the back of the ATV. I don't care which.
He turns and marches out of the cave. The wind has picked up and snow is falling. It feels like a storm front is forming, moving toward the mountains and the valley beyond. Arthur lifts his chin to gaze at the sky. You don't want to get caught in this storm, James.
Then we better hurry.
He jogs beside the ATV on the plain and walks when we enter the mountains. The origin point on the map, our destination, lies in the mountains at the edge of the dark side. If a sphere touched down here, it might have been crushed by the rocks and scattered as it fell. Wreckage might be hard to find. As we travel deeper into the mountains, shafts of dim light break over the peaks in the distance. The barren, frozen ground slowly gives way to life, shrubs at first, then giant trees that reach into the sky, trying to catch the meager scraps of sunlight. The branches have no leaves, only a blue-green spongy substance that hangs like ripped-up curtains. They remind me of the Spanish moss on the trees in the south where I grew up. The ground is black as soot, damp and soft. In the distance I hear rattling and animal calls. But the only life visible to me is the tiny insects that crawl across the trees, making the bark seem as though it's shifting back and forth. The tablet beeps, and I check the map. The location is 100 feet away. I stop the ATV and dismount, hiking the rest of the way, Arthur plodding along in front of me. Up ahead, I spot the mouth of a cave. It's wide, tall, and dark, an opening that goes right into the side of a mountain near its base. The destination is somewhere inside. Arthur stops and opens his mouth, but I draw the weapon and motion him forward.
Keep moving.
He shrugs. I thought maybe you'd want to go in first.
I don't. It might be dangerous.
Finally, he's right about something. A gust sways the trees, sending pieces of the moss-like substance drifting down like confetti in a ticker tape parade. The storm's coming, Arthur says, as the moss collects in his hair. I wave the weapon again, and he continues into the cave. Within a few feet, the darkness is complete. I turn on my headlamp and study the walls. They're rock, black and damp like the forest floor. After another wave of the gun, Arthur marches forward. The cave turns, and when I round the corner, the headlamp rakes over piles of bones. I grip the gun tighter as my heart thunders in my chest. Slowly, Arthur turns to me, his face half in shadow. I step back until I feel the cold of the cave wall on my back. I glance left, then right, searching for any predators that might live down here. But I don't see any. The cave is dead silent. I move my light to the bones once more. The piles stretch out so far I can't see the end. Only then do I realize they're human.
Who are they?
I whisper. Arthur's voice is loud, echoing off the rock walls like a megaphone. You know who they are.
What is this?
This is the end of the road you're traveling, James.
Chapter 3. Emma. For a long moment, the command post is silent. All eyes study the drone video feed on the screen. A sea of red heat signatures is moving through the jungle, heading directly for Jericho City. We'll never survive contact with this many E-Rex. Even before we came down to the planet, we knew that the Eos Rex was the most dangerous predator on this world. We called him E-Rex because they resemble the T-Rex from Earth's past. Both are lizard-like, with thick, scaly skin. The E-Rex also runs on two muscular hind legs. But whereas the T-Rex had two small arms on its torso, the E-Rex has four, two longer arms and two shorter. It also has a long tail with a sharp spike at the end. We've seen its spirits prey with that spike, then use the arms to rip it apart. To date, the E-Rex have killed 7 of our people, 5 soldiers and 2 adults who were hunting in the western jungle. We've killed twice as many of the E-Rex, though it wasn't easy. Their skin is tough, and the bone in their skulls is tougher. It takes 2 or 3 shots to pierce the brain. A shot through the eyes, nose, or mouth will do as well, but as fast as they move, that's a tall order. Their vision is principally infrared, which, along with a heightened sense of smell, is how they locate their prey. Once we figured that out, we created the suits, like the one I'm wearing. That enabled us to move unseen and to defend ourselves. Against a few E-Rex, a team of cloaked humans stands a chance. Not against what's coming for us now. The herd of E-Rex moving toward Jericho City must number in the thousands. Brightwell breaks the silence. How long before the leading edge reaches us? Corporal Aguilar chews his lip as he studies his terminal. 30 minutes, give or take. Troops are continuing to arrive at the command post, men and women apparently not needed for the lockdown protocol and not subject to it. The crowded one-room building is overflowing out into the street, people shuffling and elbowing as they try to catch a glimpse of the screens. Brightwell turns to a tall captain standing just inside the doorway. Her name is Rachel Harris, and she's 3rd in the chain of command for Jericho City's armed forces. Captain, execute Omega Protocol. Form on the herd's vector and shoot anything that breaches the tree line. Omega Protocol mobilizes our entire army and arrays them at the city's perimeter for its defense. As the captain departs, Brightwell nods to me and cuts through the crowd to join me in a nook at the back of the room. She keeps her eyes on the screens and her voice low. We don't have the firepower to stop a herd this large. Can we evacuate? I ask. Not everyone, and those who do get out might be overrun. Brightwell's piercing eyes betray no emotion. It's as if she's just recounted today's lunch menu. We can't fight, and we can't run. What does that leave? One thing is certain. It's my decision to make. It's been 6 months since we completed the buildings of Jericho City and began settling our families here. 4 months ago, we held elections. To my shock and horror, I was elected mayor. I don't know exactly why. James thinks it was my experience on the ISS and, in his words, my leadership during the long winter, when we were trapped in the Citadel and in those difficult months before we left. I think he was glad I was elected. It's given me less time to wonder about what he's doing. We've had our share of challenges here on Eos, but I never imagined we would face a conflict like this. In our last year on Earth, we endured similar crises, but we fought them as a team. Fowler, Harry, Charlotte, and Earls were all at the table, giving their opinions and sharpening our plans. They're all gone now, as are the rest of the colonists from the Carthage. Vanished. Their settlement, almost a mirror image of ours, lies deserted. The buildings crumbling and caved in by tree limbs. Is what's happening here the same thing that happened to them? We searched the Carthage settlement several times for clues about what happened to them. We found several data drives, but they were all damaged beyond repair. Our best guess is that they decided to leave for some reason and never returned. Time and weather have demolished many of the buildings. We made the conscious decision not to build our settlement next to those ruins. There were the practical considerations, that there might still be a pathogen buried somewhere in Carthage City, and that crumbling buildings are a bad place for kids to play. I think there were also psychological considerations. Eos is a new start for all of us. Building our city in the shadow of Carthage City would have reminded us every day of the friends we lost, and that Eos harbors dangers even the best of us couldn't survive. Maybe we should have heeded the warning of our lost colony more. But after what happened on Earth, we were all anxious to start over, to get back to a normal life and a future for our kids. At this moment, that future might be slipping away. Keeping my voice low, I ask, "What are our options, Colonel?" "Our best chance is to divert the herd, but we also need to know why they're stampeding. It might be a predator, but my guess is they're running from a storm. Either way, anything that's bad enough to send the E-Rex running could be a bigger threat to us than the stampede itself. I suggest we use the video feeds from the drones and the telemetry from the Carthage to survey the area. If it is a storm, we'll need Dr. Morgan to predict its course ASAP. If that herd does go through the city, what are our chances of survival?" "Impossible to say, ma'am." "Best guess?" "Low." I chew my lip, contemplating this impossible decision. "Start making preparations in case we need to evacuate the city, and let's figure out why that herd is stampeding and where they might be going." "Yes, ma'am." With that, Brightwell turns and begins issuing orders. A few minutes later, Aguilar calls out, "Ma'am, the relay balloons have reached altitude. We have active comms with the Carthage." "Retrieve aerial imagery," Brightwell says. Izumi, Min, and Grigori arrive at the command post in time to see the first image from Carthage, which shows Eos's dark side from orbit. Ice covers everything but the mountain peaks that border the valley and the wide rivers that stretch across its expanse. But that's not what draws everyone's attention. There's a massive storm on the dark side. It looks like a hurricane, with a wide eye and spiral arms lashing out. It hovers at the intersection of two major rivers. My first thought is of James. My fear gets the best of me. In my mind's eye, I see the storm rolling him across the tundra like a rag doll, smashing him into a tree or tossing him into the mountains. There's nowhere to hide out there. I grab a radio from the table and speak quickly. "James, this is Jericho CP. Do you copy?" I wait, but there's no response. "James, do you read?" Still no response. Was he close by when the storm formed? Is he still out there? If so, he's in danger. I turn to Brightwell. "We need IR from the Carthage." She nods, and Aguilar types quickly at his terminal. "IR overlay requested." He pauses. "Delta image caps downloading." A second later, the image on the screen updates, showing the storm's arms churning counterclockwise. It's moving upriver, toward the mountains and the valley. I don't see any human life signs. Did James already flee the storm? Or has it already hit him? Things are even worse for us. The E-Rex are coming at us from the western jungle, and this deadly storm is approaching from our east. It doesn't make sense. Why are the E-Rex charging toward the storm? They must be running from something else. Another storm to the west? In that moment, Dr. Morgan enters the command post. "You called?" He stops in mid-sentence, his eyes wide as he stares at the screen. Charles Morgan was one of the top climatologists in the United States before the long winter. His team at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Agency, or NOAA, modeled the long winter and made some of the most precise predictions. I'm hoping he can do the same for us now. "Doctor," Brightwell asks, snapping him out of his trance. "Is this all you have?" he whispers. Aguilar hits a few keys and the Delta image caps join to make a choppy video that shows the massive storm moving along the river toward the mountains that border our valley. Morgan leans forward, adjusting his thick glasses. "This is unexpected. Will it impact us?" "Definitely." "How?" "How fast is the storm moving? And what's the top wind speed?" Aguilar answers a few seconds later. "It's moving at 10 clicks an hour. Max wind speed is 100 kph. Morgan shakes his head. "This is bad.
Brightwell exhales impatiently.
Can you be more specific, Doctor?
Not really. Not with this much data.
He throws his hands up.
We lived on Earth for millions of years, studied its climate for thousands of years. We've been here a year. We still have no idea what Eos is capable of. We don't even know...
My voice calm, I lock eyes with Morgan.
Doctor, tell us what you do know. Please do it quickly.
He takes a deep breath.
Eos is turning slightly because of that rogue planet passing by. Its gravity is exerting a pull on us.
He cocks his head.
The effect is that our valley is being turned toward the star, just slightly, but enough to cause some major issues. Namely, it's making the valley hotter and more humid. Warm air from the desert is spilling into the jungles. The worst is what's happening to the rivers. This valley serves as a natural filter between the warm and cool sides of the planet. Warm water flows from the desert into the valley, where it cools before it reaches the dark side. With this change, the water reaching the dark side is now warmer.
Morgan points at the screen.
That storm is going to travel up that river, feeding on the warm water like a power source. If it reaches the mountains, the storm surge will send water back into the valley, and the storm could possibly shear the ice caps from the ridges, allowing even more warm water out of the valley and onto the dark side. It's a spiraling process until that planet passes.
What does that mean for us, here? I ask.
I'm guessing the city will see a lot of rain. Snow will fall in the eastern jungle. The rivers will surge. The valley might even flood. That's probably why this area is grassland, and why I told you we should have studied the planet for longer before we settled here.
That's enough, Dr. Morgan. We've been over this. We didn't have enough rations on the Jericho for a prolonged study.
We could have settled in the mountains.
This is not the time, Dr. Morgan.
This discussion has reared its head more and more since the storms began.
When we arrived at Eos, we briefly considered settling in the foothills, or even the mountains, but it would have been harder to farm there. That's likely the same reason the Carthage colonists settled nearby. We never imagined the climate would change so drastically so quickly.
The storm is a problem, but it's not the reason we called you,
Brightwell says to Morgan.
As I'm sure you're aware, the sound in the distance is an E-Rex stampede.
She motions to Aguilar, who brings up the drone footage that begins with the canopy over Jericho City and continues on into the western jungle, displaying the sea of red heat signatures.
Given the E-Rex are moving toward the storm on the dark side, I assume it's not what's causing the stampede.
Morgan seems stunned. Finally, he says,
Doubtful. Show me telemetry from the desert.
It's 7 hours old, Brightwell says.
That's when Jericho last flew over.
Those two drones will reach the desert in... She eyes Aguilar, who says,
Less than a minute.
Show us real-time imagery from the drones. On the screen, the drone footage shows the canopy of the western jungle, which is decimated. Massive trees have been thrown to the ground, shattered and strewn about like toothpicks. Many E-Rex also lie on the ground. Some were crushed by the falling trees, but others are seemingly unharmed. Their heat signatures glow on the screen. They're alive. So why aren't they getting up? Fear?
Again, I wonder, what are they running from? What has forced this many to flee, more than we've ever seen before? And why have so many fallen?
On the screen, the western mountain range looms at the edge of the jungle. Beyond the mountains lies the vast desert that stretches across the light side of Eos. Above the ridgeline, a wall of sand and wind spreads out.
A sandstorm,
Brightwell says quietly.
Is that what the herd is running from?
Maybe,
Morgan whispers.
At least one of the sandstorms breached the mountains and flattened some of the jungle.
He steps closer to the screen and points.
There, look. Focus on that downed E-Rex.
The image zooms in on the fallen beast. It's not moving. Deep cuts run all over its body, as if a razor blade sliced into it 1,000 times.
I'm guessing this is why they're running,
Morgan says.
It's not the sandstorm. It's a predator that is following the storm and the warm air from the desert into the jungle.
Still pointing at the image of the dead E-Rex,
He turns to Brightwell and me. If this predator can do that to the E-Rex, we don't stand a chance.
Chapter 4. James. A whistling sound screams from the mouth of the cave, reaching down into the darkness like a ghost calling for me. Arthur turns slightly toward the sound. The storm has begun, James. Leave now. There's something down here you don't want me to find. Or maybe I just don't want you to get yourself killed. I push off from the wall and step toward the bones, my headlamp illuminating them. It's the saddest, most grotesque thing I've ever seen. The remains of people lying in piles. The skeletons of children hugging the adults. I recognize the clothes. These are AU uniforms. The fatigues have been dyed green, just like ours back at Jericho City. The wind grows louder by the second. If there is a storm out there, it is indeed picking up. I skirt the edge of the bones, careful not to disturb them, and cast my light deeper into the cave. The bodies there are better preserved. The skin is gray, the hair and nails brittle. They look almost like corpses in a morgue. Indeed, the cave provides an almost ideal place to preserve them. It's dark and cold. The moisture, however, isn't ideal. I squat beside the first bodies, the skeletons, to inspect them closer. Tiny insects are crawling over the bones. That's what took away the flesh. No doubt bacteria did their share of the work, too. Moisture enables the bugs and the bacteria to survive down here. As I stand, my headlamp passes over a pair of blue coveralls similar to the ones I wore in the warehouse in Camp 9. The face above is gray and sunken, but I recognize my old friend lying among the dead. Harry, I whisper as I move to his body. Fowler is beside him, and Charlotte is a few feet away, hugging two smaller bodies. These are the Carthage colonists. Our lost colony has been found. But why here? At the origin, or termination, of the Eye of the Grid? My light glints off something in Harry's hand. I reach down and gently move his stiff fingers, wincing as I touch his cold, dead skin. It's a small data drive. I stare at it a long moment. For some reason, I instinctively sense that it's a message he's left for me. Here, where he knew I would find it, deep in this cave that is safe from the storms and predators and whatever else lies in wait for us on Eos. But I dread what it will tell me, and I can't possibly ignore it. I plug the drive into the tablet. It brings up a list of hundreds of files, documents, charts, logs from medical devices and test results. At the top of the file listing is a video named _hello-world. I open it. Harry's face fills the screen. He's sitting in a cave. This cave, by the looks of it. A dim light shines on his face from below. His voice is soft, as if he doesn't want the people nearby to hear him. Welcome to this week's episode of Tales from the Crypt. He raises his eyebrows theatrically and settles into a somber smile. That's probably not as funny as I think it is. But hey, how many times does a joke like that present itself? Actually, that show was probably before your time anyway. He stares directly into the camera. I'm leaving this for you, James, because I figure you'll be the one who finds this place. I hope learning what happened to us will help you. It'll become obvious soon why we didn't go back to the camp, why we came here. He swallows, as if gathering his thoughts. It all started with the storm.
Chapter 5. Emma. I feel all eyes in the command post staring at me, waiting for my orders. I want to pick up the radio and call to James again, but my first duty is to this colony. I've been here once before, in a similar situation, where seconds were the difference between life and death, when the people I was responsible for were under attack. That day was my last aboard the International Space Station. I watched my entire crew die in the blink of an eye. I've replayed those seconds a million times in my mind. I know I will do the same with these seconds. Brightwell drifts closer to me. turning her back to the eyes on us, her voice low.
Given the predator that's driving the E-Rex and the storm behind them, I don't think we can divert the herd, not all of them. And the storm on the dark side might just drive them right back to the city again. One way or the other, odds are we'll be overrun.
You said before that we can't evacuate everyone before the herd arrives. That means we can evacuate some, correct?
She nods. Maybe half. Possibly more. We need to hurry.
Proceed, Colonel. Evacuate as many as you can and make preparations for those who will have to stay. Brightwell barks orders at the soldiers around the room, no longer trying to be quiet. We're not hiding anymore. Leaving will be noisy. When the stampedes began, we created an evacuation plan. A scouting team identified a cave at the base of the eastern mountain range that we believe will serve as a viable shelter. The team hasn't had time to return to the cave and do a thorough survey, or even explore far beyond the entrance. I pressed them to at least venture farther and map the passages and chambers, but the expedition leader insisted that they would only find more cave, and that even if the cave isn't big enough for our population, there are a dozen more close by that could be used for the overflow. The evacuation prep team has instead focused their efforts on clearing a path to the cave, the reasoning being that if we don't have a way to get to the cave, it doesn't matter how large it is. I suppose they were right. I just hope the cave will hold us. Most of the colonists will walk, or run, to the cave. We'll use the ATVs to transport those who can't make it on foot. The plan is to station troops in the woods to guard against E-Rex and other predators attacking the convoy. I fear those troops may be nothing more than sacrifices left along our path to slow our enemy. James knows the location of the cave. When he sees what's happening, hopefully he'll meet us there. How far out is the herd now? I ask. Aguilar responds, about 25 minutes, ma'am. What are our options for slowing them down? I ask Brightwell. I've got a tactical team in the jungle along their vector. The alphas will be at the head of the pack. We take them down and hope that the herd disperses or changes course. We'll also fire along the northern flank of the formation, trying to force them south. As you know, the evac cave lies to the northeast. Do it. Brightwell gives the order as I stare at the blue dot on the map, the cave that is our best hope of survival. Other options? I ask. Brightwell shakes her head. I don't see any. We don't have any heavy artillery. We do have something that will burn, though. Brightwell cocks her head, confused. The field. Burn it. Brightwell's eyes go wide with surprise. She quickly brings her reaction under control as I lay out my plan. Use the grass hooks to cut a perimeter around the city, then light it up. If we're right about the E-Rex's visual ability, they'll see a wall of red and smell the smoke long before they reach the city. That might keep them away, Brightwell says cautiously. But the fire won't stop at the tree line. The jungle could burn too, and the wind could carry the flames back into the city. The canopy is fire retardant, but it will provide limited protection. Let's worry about getting out first. If we live, then we'll worry about where we're going to live. Yes, ma'am. Brightwell issues the orders and turns back to me. Your vehicle will be ready. I'm staying. She takes a deep breath. I know what's coming next. I'm staying, I repeat. Till the very last person is out of this city, so let's focus. What's next? Over the command post speakers, a man's voice whispers, CP, Team Alpha, we're in position, awaiting fire authorization. Brightwell clicks the microphone at her station. Team Alpha, CP, fire at will. On the screen, I watch the red dots of the herd, the diamond formation moving through the jungle. Ahead of it are five green dots, our people, hopefully safe in the trees above the stampede. From the drone's non-infrared images, I see trees tumbling as the herd moves. The canopy above us ripples. The ground shakes. My mind drifts to Sam, Allie, and Carson. I hope Madison or Abby is taking care of them. They're probably scared to death. I'm scared to death. Aguilar's voice breaks the silence. Ma'am, one E-Rex confirmed kill. Herd is shifting. The diamond formation breaks. Several of the E-Rex at the head of the herd slow, but those behind keep pace. They transform into an upside-down triangle that slowly breaks in two. Brightwell grabs the microphone on her desk.
Alpha team, move north and engage the herd splitting off. Drive them south at all costs.
When the response comes, I hear what sounds like something moving down a zip line.
Alpha team, Alpha One, dismount and move north. On me, no time for elevated cover. Fire from the ground and keep moving. Use the trunks for cover.
The E-Rex will overrun them, even if they hide behind the trees. Brightwell turns and finds a captain in the group.
Emilio, get Bravo team into the jungle. Same orders, drive them south. At all costs, Captain.
With a nod, the man vanishes into the darkness. Behind him, ATVs are being loaded, kids are crying, and adults are yelling. Beyond the canopy, the thunder of the stampede grows louder. I pick up a handheld radio and activate it.
James, do you copy? Please respond.
I wait, then try again. James, a herd is moving toward the city. We're evacuating to the cave. Please, respond. As I listen for a response, I realize Grigori and Min are standing next to me, staring.
What?
We want to alter the ship's orbit, Min says.
Why?
We can't establish a geosynchronous orbit because the hill sphere...
I know. What sort of orbit are we talking about?
I ask.
Around the Terminator.
Min replies,
it will give us visual on the rest of the valley around the planet. We might find a better place to go.
It's not a perfect solution,
Grigori says.
The ship will have to veer out of orbit to grab sunlight for solar cells.
Do it, and disassemble four of the comm panels and protect them. The herd might destroy the field.
Of course,
Min says,
and we have another idea.
I nod to him and he continues,
the canopy. We can detach it and bring it to the ground. Use it as a shield.
That's brilliant. Get to it. Outside the command post, automatic gunfire erupts.
Chapter 6. James. In the video, Harry says, I think I should probably start at the beginning, with the spheres. I think somehow they're connected to the storms, but I'm still not sure. He holds up his tablet. The image is one I've come to know very well in the last 9 months. The Eye of the Grid. I'm assuming you found the symbol I left at Carthage City, or maybe you found it yourself. Let me tell you how I found it. Shortly after we arrived on Eos, I built a rover and started searching the dark side of the planet for rare metals. We were trying to manufacture incendiary rounds to kill or divert those giant dinosaur-like predators. We call them Eos Rex, or E-Rex for short. They weren't a problem at first, but the herds kept moving closer to the city. When the rover located the first sphere, I thought it was the core of a meteor. Imagine my surprise when I dug down and saw it. A smooth, hollow obsidian sphere. There was no question it was alien in origin. It was empty, and there were no clues about who made it or why. I thought there might be other spheres out here, so I built two more rovers. I even tried to get the drones in on the search. I found a second sphere, then a third. By then the pattern was clear. They were arranged in an arcing line, and the spacing of the spheres followed a formula. Following the line back and forth, I found the rest of the spheres. They were all identical, with one exception. They got larger as they moved to the start of the line, or the end, depending on your perspective. Anyway, the largest sphere was also empty. But it was different from the others in one other way. It had this symbol engraved on the outside. He holds the tablet up again, showing me the Eye of the Grid. I was shocked. Charlotte thought it might be some sort of code language or even a frequency of some sort that would make the spheres do something. We studied the image for weeks. Obviously, we left the spheres where they were. Charlotte was convinced that moving them was a bad idea, that they might need the cold weather, or that displacing them could set in motion some security measure or other dangerous event. Harry lets the tablet fall back to his lap. But we got nowhere, with either the spheres or the symbol. The only thing the symbol gave us was two points we didn't have on the arcing line. At one location, the one on the outside, we found nothing. And at the location in the center of the symbol, where the line starts, we found this cave. I was excited then. I was sure it was the key to unlocking the mystery of the spheres. He shakes his head.
I searched it from top to bottom for weeks, but there's nothing here. It's empty. Maybe whatever was here has already been taken. A geocached treasure found long ago. Or maybe it's some sick joke the grid is playing on us. I never got to find out, because we soon had other problems. Harry takes a deep breath, steeling himself. When we arrived at Eos, we surveyed the solar system. We didn't see anything that might disrupt the orbit or climate of Eos. Obviously, we were wrong. There's a dwarf planet in this system with a complex orbit impacted by several bodies. Long story short, it's passing near Eos now, just close enough to exert a small gravitational pull. The valley is being pulled toward the star. Heat is pouring in from the desert, bringing storms with it. And the warm front spilling onto the dark side, along with the warmer rivers, is also causing storms. The storms themselves weren't the real problem, though. The Erex stampedes were. They started slowly at first, small groups running through the jungle for the plains, coinciding with the storms. We thought they would pass. But then a massive storm swept out in the desert. It sent a massive herd of Erex fleeing the jungle. It had to be thousands. We just ran. We put everything down and evacuated. Earls ordered his troops into the jungle, every last one of them. Hundreds of men and women. The plan was for them to shell the herds and divert them. The sounds over the radio. For the first time, I hear someone else on the video, coughing in the distance. Harry stares beyond the tablet and calls out, "Lawrence! You okay?" He jumps up, taps the tablet, and the screen goes blank, but only for a second. It resumes with Harry again sitting in the floor of the cave. He looks different now. Empty, beaten. His voice is a whisper, emotionless. "The last thing I did when I left the city was put the symbol on the comm panels. In the event we didn't return, I hoped you would see it and figure it out. As I said, I think it's connected to what happens on Eos somehow. The orbit of the planets, the ecosystem disruption. Maybe it's a warning." He pauses. "We never heard from our troops again. They must have been overrun. We didn't go looking. We knew what we would find. The predators in those jungles don't let carrion lie long. We retreated to a cave in the eastern jungle, at the base of the mountains. It was the logical place to wait out the herds and the storms. The complex was vast, and Earls liked it because it had only one entrance, making it easy to defend from anything out there. What we didn't know was what was waiting for us inside that cave. It changed everything."
Chapter 7. Emma. It's absolute chaos in the command post. Brightwell is shouting orders. Grigori dashes through the exit, off to bring down the canopy. Min is typing furiously at the comm terminal, issuing new orders to the Carthage. Izumi is gone, probably prepping the sick in the infirmary for transport. The ground vibrates. The gunfire is unrelenting. From the long table, Aguilar turns to Brightwell.
5 Erex running ahead of the herd have reached us. They've slowed in the field.
He pauses, listening to his headset.
1 down. The other 4 are wounded. They're breaking off.
The gunfire will no doubt draw the herd's attention, but what choice do we have? "Alpha team, respond," Brightwell calls over the radio. On the screen, the troops' green markers aren't moving. The drones can locate the transponders in the suits, but they can't tell us if the people inside are still alive. Brightwell shakes her head. "Bravo team, respond." There's no answer. Both teams are down. Or they're surrounded and can't make a sound. I hope for the latter. Outside, the gunfire ceases. In its wake, I hear other sounds. The roar of the herd in the jungle. Voices yelling here in the city. Vehicles speeding away. Through the command post doorway, I see ATV tracks kicking up dirt as they drive across the city's hard-packed streets. The evacuation has started. We have a little over 5,000 people in Jericho City. We would need 100 buses to evacuate them, and we don't have any buses. What we have are ATVs with tracks pulling trailers. We typically use the trailers to carry material and food back to the city. Now those trailers are loaded with people. Those who can't make the hike,
mostly the young and the old. They're packed in tight, holding each other. Brightwell was right. We'll never get everyone out in time. Waking up 5,000 people and getting them out of the city in 25 minutes just isn't possible.
10 minutes,
Aguilar calls out. Outside, I hear Madison calling my name. I dash out of the command post into the open. People are everywhere, thousands of them. The convoy leaving the city already reaches to the eastern jungle, the lead ATV out of sight. Troops are spaced out along the western side of the convoy, ready to engage any E-Recs that come their way. I snake through the crowd, following her voice. The heat is suffocating. Finally, I break through and find Madison holding Carson. Allie and Sam are beside her. Her own children, Owen and Adeline, are squeezed in behind her, holding hands, forming a protective barrier of sorts. Madison's husband, David, is beyond the crowd, loading people onto trailers hooked to the ATVs. James's brother, Alex, and his wife, Abby, are also helping to load people. Their two children, Jack and Sarah, stand close to Madison, faces serious, hands held out to keep the crowd from pressing into her.
There's room on our trailer, Madison says, holding Carson out to me. I can get your things from your flat.
I gently press Carson back into her arms. I'm right behind you.
What? I have to help with things here.
Madison glances in the direction of the thundering herd, then back at me, silently making her point.
Mom?
Allie cries, reaching for me. I squat and pull her into a tight hug, then put my arm around Sam. They're puffy-eyed, still half asleep, both scared. Sam is putting on a brave face, as usual. I kiss Allie on the forehead. Sam wiggles as I plant a kiss on him, too.
Listen to your aunt. I'll be along soon, and she'll tell me if you act up.
I stare at them, my expression stern. They're used to seeing that. Right now, I'm hoping that warning them about getting into trouble for disobeying will subtly put them at ease, assuring them that my discipline is the only danger they face.
The E-Rex, Sam begins.
We'll pass soon, I finish. Now get going. When they turn to join their cousins, I hug Madison and Carson in her arms.
Thank you,
I whisper. Alex walks towards us, squinting as he moves through the crowd.
Where's James?
On his way. He'll join us soon. I leave it at that and hope I'm right. Overhead, the canopy groans, the sound of steel bending, the massive cover sliding sideways on its rails. I glance up and see Grigori at the top of one of the giant piers. Two of his technicians are atop other piers. At night, the canopy is positioned toward the desert, but now we need it to move slightly toward the western jungle, and to come down all the way to the ground. The steel groans again and the canopy shudders. Just beyond the canopy, a small group of soldiers with grass hooks are felling the tall blue-green grass in broad strokes, making a sort of firebreak that we hope will keep the blaze from the city. Another group of soldiers collects the fallen grass into stacks away from the city. Still more soldiers, holding rifles at the ready, creep forward as the grass falls, ready to fire on any E-Rex emerging from the forest. I hear the pitter-patter of rain falling on the canopy. The blue-green sea of grass sways in the wind. Suddenly, the blades begin to glisten as rain falls in sheets. Not great timing for our whole burn-the-field plan. Rushing back to the command post, I hear Dr. Morgan's voice before I reach the threshold.
I have no idea. Without aerial footage, it's impossible to predict.
When I'm inside, Brightwell locks eyes with me.
It's raining.
I know. Light the field up, now. Brightwell gives the order. On the screen, the herds are almost out of the jungle. They've slowed some. One group will miss us by a wide margin. The other is still heading for us on a vector slightly north. They'll pass the city and overrun the convoy. It's a worst-case scenario.
How long is the trip to the cave? I ask.
Aguilar shrugs.
About 15 minutes. The first vehicles should arrive in 5 minutes or so.
There's a crash outside the door.
Canopy is in place,
Aguilar says.
A minute later, the smell of smoke drifts into the command post, putrid and thick. Brightwell steps close to me, speaking quietly.
We have to stop the evac. The people who've already departed might make it to the cave, and those leaving on vehicles now. But anyone leaving after might get caught out on the plane when the herd gets here.
I nod. She's right. Anyone out there between the city and the eastern jungle will be a sitting duck.
What do we do with the people still here?
It's your call, ma'am.
I nod.
Get them back into the barracks. Crowd everyone into the flats opposite of the direction of the herd. Have them crouch against the walls. I want guard teams at every entrance. As Brightwell gives the order, I step out of the command post just in time to see the ATV pulling a trailer with Madison on it, Carson in her arms, Allie and Sam beside her. They're getting out. They'll reach the cave.
Chapter 8. James. Arthur steps closer to me. Stop the video now, James. I draw the energy weapon and train it on him. Back up! He holds up his hands. That's no way to treat someone trying to help you. This video is what you were afraid I would find down here, isn't it? Or something like it. He glances away as if bored. How does me seeing this harm the grid? Maybe it harms you, James. We'll see about that. Still holding the energy weapon, I press play, and Harry continues his story. We evacuated nearly 4,000 residents to the cave. About 200 feet in, we noticed a spongy substance on the cave walls and floor. It was black, almost indistinguishable from the rock it grew on. Whenever someone approached a sponge, it would release a fine powdery substance, almost like pollen, but gray. He smiles ruefully. Fowler and I called them regolith sponges. The color and fine powder reminded us of moon dust. We figured it was harmless. Harry falls silent. His eyes fill with tears. The kids were the first to get sick. Coughing, fever. By the time we figured out what was happening, everyone was sick. We'd brought some medicine with us. We tried everything. Antibiotics, antivirals, anti-inflammatories. We were even testing.